agenda today, and we're going to take a little in a little different order because of all the sign-ups we have from folks on House Bill 3279. We're going to be holding the public hearing on that first, and then going back and taking the agenda in the order that is House Bills 2448, 2909, and 3313. We don't intend to take any of these to work session. The possible work session notice was sort of a standard we've been using just so we have the opportunity to move more technical bills on the day they first come to hearing. I will now open a public hearing on House Bill 3279. Council Kelmanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3279 establishes that public high school student journalists have the right to exercise freedom of speech and of the press in school-sponsored media. The bill establishes that school-sponsored media produced primarily by student journalists at public institutions of higher education are, quote, public forums for expression by the student journalists, end quote, and are not subject to review by school administrators prior to publication. The bill establishes that high school and college student journalists are, quote, responsible for determining the news, opinion, feature, and advertising content of school-sponsored media. House Bill 3279 prohibits schools from disciplining a student media advisor, which is defined as a person employed by the school district or college to supervise school-sponsored media, for refusing to suppress the protected expression of student journalists. The bill clarifies that it does not authorize expression by high school student journalists that is either libelous or slanderous, that constitutes an unwarranted invasion of privacy, or that creates a clear and present danger of the commission of unlawful acts on school premises, the violation of school policies, or the material and substantial disruption of the orderly operation of the school. The bill authorizes civil actions for injunctive or declaratory relief with awards of costs and attorney's fees for prevailing plaintiffs based on violations of the bill. The bill establishes that school boards, school officials, or governing boards of public institutions of higher education may not be held criminally or civilly responsible for any expression published by student journalists unless the officials interfered with the content of the expression. The bill requires school districts to adopt a written student freedom of expression policy, which includes reasonable provisions for the time, place, and manner of student expression.
Okay, we have Representative Galizio and Representative Cannon, who are from among the sponsors. Gentlemen. In whatever order you care to serve.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning. For the record, Larry Galizio, State Representative, House District 35, and appreciate the committee taking time to hear this bill. I understand you have quite an ambitious agenda today and for the rest of the session, so we'll try to be as concise as possible. And with that, just some big picture first, and then let others probably go into some of the specifics. Mr. Chair, you know, democratic theory makes it really clear that it's necessary to have a robust, free press. It's a necessary condition of a democracy, and a vibrant free press plays a key role in fostering an informed citizenry and a free marketplace of ideas. The recent example of the Washington Post journalism in regards to the Walter Reed Hospital, I think, is a great example of how important good journalism truly is. The early experiences and education of our journalists is very important, and it's in the best interest, I think, of all of us here to help create an environment and the conditions in which our student journalists not only learn about the craft of journalism itself, but their role as significant voices in our communities. So it's in this spirit that I bring to this committee House Bill 3279. The bill basically seeks to do three primary things. First, clarify and affirm that student journalists indeed have the right to exercise freedom of speech and press in school-sponsored media. Second, allow a civil cause of action should a violation of these rights occur. And third, clarify that school officials and boards are immune from civil and criminal liability based on student expression in school-sponsored media. Now, I think you'll hear today that there's some disagreement about the real and potential impact of at least one recent court case and one perhaps that's currently before the Supreme Court. And there are concerns about the effect of the particular bill as written in its current form and whether or not it's even necessary at all. So let me be really clear about the intent of this legislation is to strengthen and clarify the rights of student journalists both at the high school and at the college and university level. That is the intent of the legislation. I'm very happy to work with those who have concerns. It's been interesting. This will surprise you, being on the Judiciary Committee. I found that people with law degrees often have different interpretations of the law. I found that kind of shocking. There's one recent decision that perhaps some people might talk about, and I don't know if it's pronounced Hosty or Hosty, but it's Hosty versus Carter. And this was a decision in the Seventh Circuit, which of course does not cover Oregon. But prior to the Hosty decision, courts had consistently rejected application of another case called Hazelwood, which upheld the censorship of high school media. Now, a footnote in the Hosty decision seems to leave the door open for censorship at the college and university level. Now, again, I don't have a law degree, and I'll let those folks who do perhaps get into some of the specifics in terms of the court cases and the application. But again, just to be clear, I think that because of that decision and there's one pending in the Supreme Court now, I think there's an environment where the free expression rights of student journalists might be vulnerable. And my goal is to, again, clarify and strengthen from the perspective of this body and the state of Oregon the rights of student journalists at both the high school and university level. And with that, I want to turn it over to a co-sponsor of the legislation, and thank you. And I do want to remind people on the committee that sitting in the back of the room, at least some of the people here, when you think of spring break, I think sometimes you might think of, you know, MTV and Palm Springs. Well, I think you'll also see there are students who are not necessarily just doing that. They're doing important things. They're contributing to our state and the free marketplace of ideas. And the most important thing to keep in mind, members of this committee, is that should you run for higher office or another office in the future, these very student journalists might be covering your campaign. So with that, I'll turn it over to Representative Cannon.
Well said, Representative Galizia. For the record, Ben Cannon, State Representative, District 46 in Portland. There are occasions where you see a bill posted, and it really strikes a chord. This is one of those bills. I am a former student journalist. I am a teacher, and I think this bill is very important. I was a student journalist in college and was doing the usual college thing, making trouble for our administration, for our student government, digging up whatever dirt we could and publishing it. And you can imagine my surprise when I learned, when I became editor-in-chief of that paper my senior year, that we were not, in fact, a free press. We thought of ourselves as very independent and very free, but we learned that, in fact, we were, in a sense, sort of an arm of the university, and that if they chose, administrators could tell us what to print or refuse to print what we wanted to. Upon that realization, began working with the administration to clarify our relationship with them, and over the course of a year, and I spent the summer after I graduated working on this, we established ourselves as an independent corporation, separate and distinct from the university, with its own board of directors, on which I served. And it was a real lesson in the rights that student journalists actually have. Representative Iglesias spoken to the reasons, some of the reasons why a free press is so important in a broad sort of civic sense, and I won't harp on that except to say that free marketplace of ideas does so much for our country and has historically. The First Amendment is one of the very most sacred rights, if we can sort of put measure ones against another, it certainly would be up at the top of my list. It does help ensure that a diversity of views is heard, and one can imagine the kinds of things that come up in a school setting, such as student journalists at one point who wanted to protest the fact that Martin Luther King Day was being established as a holiday, a very controversial point of view to protest that, but there were students at a high school who wanted to publish that point of view. You can imagine students taking on other hot topics, evolution, the teaching of that in their classrooms, and I think it's important, even when we disagree with those points of view, that we establish a place where they can be heard. But I also want to speak to this from the standpoint of an educator and why I think this is so important. It has real educational virtue as well. I teach civics and American history and, of course, talk a lot about our Bill of Rights. And it's very helpful as a teacher to be able to say, we're teaching it, teaching the importance of it, and we're going to help you put it into practice as well. That, in fact, you have a public forum. We're not going to abridge those rights. It establishes consistency with what I'm saying in the classroom. I think that's one important educational virtue that this bill would help establish. Another, perhaps equally or more important, is that passage of this bill would help us establish that we take student views really seriously. And there's a quote that I wanted to share from a report. It was actually in 1974 related to student press, and I think this touches on something quite important. And they said, censorship is the fundamental cause of the triviality, innocuousness, and uniformity that characterize the high school press. Where a free, vigorous student press does exist, there is a healthy ferment of ideas and opinions with no indication of disruption or negative side effects on the educational experience of the school. It's been my experience as a teacher that when you give students responsibility, when you take them seriously, when you say to them that they have the authority, the independence, and the maturity to handle complicated, complex, touchy, difficult issues seriously, that they will rise to the occasion. And that's the primary reason that, from an educational point of view, I think this bill is so valuable. There are many educators who agree. I have an article by a superintendent, she was a teacher as well, who says, the best teaching and learning means actively engaged students taking full responsibility for their work. And this was an article defending this kind of law that requires high school teachers, administrators, as college ones as well, to support a free and independent student press. So you'll hear from many others who I think can touch on the legal details of this as well as some of the journalistic implications of this better than I, but I did want to add my voice to that chorus in support of this bill and thank the good representative for bringing it to you. Thanks very much.
Representatives, thank you for bringing this forward. Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a thank you very much, Representative Glazio, and excuse me, Representative Cannon, for bringing this important issue forward. I have a question about the one of the whereas clauses. As sponsors of the bill, I'm hoping you can clarify. It says, whereas court decisions have not provided adequate protection for the free speech and free press rights of students. I wonder if this is based on any Oregon decisions that you're thinking of or only other states or jurisdictions.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonamici, thank you for that question. Based on decisions not in the state of Oregon, based on the Hazelwood decision, and the Hosty decision. So I think I'm proud to live in a state where we have a particularly vigorous First Amendment. And again, the intent of this bill is to in no way erode that First Amendment protection. So if that whereas clause is problematic, we can strike that. It's not central to this bill.
Thank you, Representative.
Especially considering you're a sponsor of the bill. Are you not? Aren't you? No, you're not.
No.
Sorry.
If there are no further questions, I want to thank you again for bringing this bill forward. As the former editor of an off-campus high school newspaper that was started in response to censorship of the Albany High School Whirlwind, on which I was editorial page editor, this is an issue that resonates with me as well. So I'll excuse them. And Representative Smith, did you want to present on this bill? We'll put you in right now then.
Why don't you take the center seat here? Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Oregon State Representative Greg Smith, and I have the distinct pleasure of representing District 57, which encompasses Moro, Wallowa, Union, and the best parts of Umatilla County. I say that because I'll never be able to run for the Senate, because the other part of Umatilla County is my Senate district. However, I truly do represent a wonderful district. thank you for giving me the opportunity to be here this morning. I'm not here actually to discuss the merits of House Bill 3279, but rather I'm here to introduce to you my intern from my office, R.J. Farnes, who is one of the finest products in Moro County and a soon-to-be graduate of Heppner High School. I have no idea what he's about to share with you, but he is here today as part of an internship that he has been conducting all this week during spring break. And one of the things I stated to him when he came into the office is that he would be required to pick one piece of legislation, choose the merits of that legislation, and come before a committee. And Chair McPherson, we thank you for giving him just this quick opportunity to share his thoughts on House Bill 3279.
Again, good morning, Mr. Chair, committee. For the record, my name is R.J. Farnes. I'm a senior at Heppner High School. I came here this morning to share a personal experience from our school. We took an attempt to incorporate freedom of speech in our school-wide newspaper, and it's a small school, so the newspaper class consisted of freshmen and seniors. And one of the attempts to do this, our teacher allowed a sophomore to write an opinion-based article on sports activities every week at the conclusion of our football games. So it was this fall. And our quarterback had a rough game, and the sophomore pretty much picked him apart like an ESPN analyst. And from that kid struggled with confidence issues for the rest of the week throughout practice because kids were teasing him, and you know, the sophomore had attacked him in the article. If he had done this, if he wouldn't have thrown that bad pass here, we could have done this, you know, we could have scored, basically in a roundabout way saying how he thought the quarterback was to blame for our loss because the teacher was allowing him to say whatever he wanted because it was an opinion-based article, and it said, like, Dalton's opinion, that was the kid's name, Dalton's opinion, but article on sports. And what happened was at the next game, our quarterback, because of struggling with confidence, didn't do as hot as well. And through what happened with the theme would become with Dalton would pick apart our quarterback at the conclusion of every Friday night game, and a week would go by where our quarterback would be tormented by the other students and be blamed consistently for our losses. And I don't think in high school where confidence and struggling to find yourself is an issue that we need somebody breathing down our neck constantly. And I think if we take away the structure that we have, what structure would there be to build upon for our journalists and aspiring journalists? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions for either of these witnesses?
Thank you very much for spending your spring break with us.
Yeah, we appreciate that. Instead of, as was commented earlier, instead of going off to a beach someplace, to come here to the Oregon's capital and observe how we deal with public policy issues, I think that's a great experience. We appreciate your being with us.
Just very quickly, Mr. Chair, I do need to set the record straight. RJ made it sound as if Heppner had multiple losses. They did win their district championship for the how many straight years?
Eight or nine
straight years in a row. So one or two losses is a significant event in Heppner football. So thank you very much for giving us this opportunity to be here.
Very good.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you, RJ. Let's hear from Dave Fedanke now.
Morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, David Fedanke, Executive Director of the American Civil Liberties Union of Oregon. And I'm in a little bit of an uncomfortable position this morning, and I'm going to try to talk about some legal concepts. Please keep in mind, I am not an attorney either, just like Representative Galizio. I have worked for the Oregon ACLU since 1982, however, and we have had a number of instances of students whose, we believe, whose speech rights, expression rights, have been violated by school officials. And our first choice is always to talk to the school officials and try to find some way of accommodating student rights. Occasionally we have found volunteer lawyers and filed lawsuits. There's really only been one in my time with the Oregon ACLU, and that's more than 25 years now, that has gotten all the way to the Oregon Supreme Court. And that was a case called Barczyk versus Kubiacik, interestingly from Representative Galizio's district, I believe. Of course, prior to his time in this body. And that case involved the Tigard High School, both the official student newspaper and an underground newspaper that was put together by some students off campus on their own time, but circulated on campus. And in response to the public, and I should tell you that I'll try not to take too much time, but it is a great story. The official paper at that time, and probably still is, at Tigard High School, is known as the High Spots. And this underground paper called itself the Low Spots. It had some things in it that were possibly not in the best of taste. But we believe very strongly that the students had constitutional right to prepare that underground newspaper and distribute it to fellow students. The school took a different view. They believed that nothing could be distributed on campus without prior authorization by school officials. They didn't have a rule to that effect at the time the Low Spots was passed out, shortly after winter break in 1992, but they adopted such a rule shortly thereafter. In the meantime, the High Spots editors wrote an editorial saying that while they would not have published the things that were in the Low Spots, they appreciated the perspective of the students who had done so. The principal of Tigard High School at the time didn't want that editorial to appear, and took the issue to the school board, and the school board agreed that it should not appear. The principal told the editors of High Spots of that decision, and they ordered the printer of the official student paper to delete that editorial and place a banner across it that said, "Censored by Principal Kubiacik and the Tigard-Tualatin School Board." What occurred was a series of actions on the part of school administrators to discipline the writers of the Low Spots, one of whom was given an in-school suspension and ordered to write an essay on speech, free speech, and responsibility. And the filing of our lawsuit on behalf of the students involved. This case took a fairly torturous route to the Oregon Supreme Court, a relatively quick route based on my experience, The opinion came down in May of 1995, so barely 3 years after the beginning of this case. And unfortunately, while the Oregon Supreme Court noted the existence of the Oregon protections of free expression in Article 1, Section 8 of the Oregon Bill of Rights, which states that no law shall be passed restraining the free expression of opinion or the right to speak, write, or print freely on any subject whatever, but every person shall be responsible for the abuse of this right. The court said that, noting its prior decisions, that there was no right per se under the Oregon Constitution to seek damages for a violation of the Oregon Constitution. The court looked at this case and said, well, can we even reach that issue of whether or not there was a violation of the free speech rights and free press rights, if there are any, of high school students? Said, well, gosh, after this case started, I mean, these students, most of them were seniors at the time of the incident, which, again, was January of 1992. Most of them graduated that spring. Here we are 3 years later. The case is moot as to those students because they've all graduated. There is no current case or controversy that to be decided because these students are no longer subject to the rules that were adopted by the school district. The court went on to look at some of the federal constitutional issues, found that most of those issues were also moot for the same reasons, except with regard to Scott Barchik, who had written the underground newspaper and who had been subjected to the in-school suspension. And all the court said about his disciplinary action was that he was entitled to review of whether that disciplinary action was justifiable or not. In the end, the school district agreed to eliminate any mention of the disciplinary proceedings in his file, and the case went away. So we still don't know, even though that case went all the way up, whether or not high school students in Oregon have free speech rights under the Oregon Constitution, much less whether high school journalists have free expression or free press rights under the Oregon Bill of Rights. And you've heard from Representative Galizio that there are the same kinds of concerns about whether students have rights under the First Amendment. And originally this type of legislation was brought forward after the Hazelwood decision that Representative Galizio mentioned, to try to put into statute the standards that had been in place prior to the Hazelwood decision by the U.S. Supreme Court. I signed up this morning as neutral on this legislation, Mr. Chair, because we have very mixed feelings about the particular language of this bill and what it is trying to do. Ideally, the ACLU would like to have a mechanism to determine whether students have constitutional rights in Oregon and what those rights are. To be able to pursue that, we would have to have a statute that allowed students to sue for violations of their state constitutional rights and would at least allow for recovery of nominal damages. Because under the current Oregon law for declaratory judgment, the declaratory judgment statute, there has to be an ongoing controversy that will be affected by the outcome of a court decision. Now, you may be able to get that in circuit court with high school students or college students, for that matter. But you're never going to be able to get a decision from the Court of Appeals or the Oregon Supreme Court before those students graduate, as a practical matter. Maybe you might get a Court of Appeals decision on behalf of university students that are freshmen when the case starts. A long shot, you might, maybe, possibly get an Oregon Supreme Court decision, but very unlikely. And because the Oregon courts don't recognize the exception to the mootness doctrine that every other court in the United States does recognize, which is for cases that are capable of repetition yet that would evade review on appeal, because Oregon doesn't recognize that exception, because our Oregon Supreme Court gives a literal reading to its powers under the state constitution, unless there is some mechanism for recovering damages, even if that might be nominal damages, there is no way to get these issues, these legal issues, resolved. I can assure you that the ACLU is not interested in rushing into court based on a frivolous case or a case that can, an instance that can be negotiated with school officials. But as things stand today, high school officials virtually have a blank check when it comes to the constitutional rights of students, because students have no legal remedy as a practical matter to pursue violations of their free speech rights. And we get regular complaints, mostly about underground newspapers, not official school papers. And those complaints have come from, yeah, sure, from Portland, from Elkton, from Echo. We haven't had a complaint from Heppner yet, but it wouldn't surprise me if we were to get one at some point. And, you know, we argue in most situations that the answer to speech that people don't like, whether the people that don't like the speech are school administrators or taxpayers or school board members, the answer to that speech is more speech. To talk about, well, what's the problem here? And we want to teach high school students and certainly university students to be good citizens. And to be good citizens of our country, they need to understand what the Constitution says. They need to know that, yes, speech can hurt people, and to be aware of that, and to be responsible. But if the reaction of school administrators is to say, no, you can't say that, and if you do say that, we're going to suspend you, or we're going to kick you off the school paper, or we're going to give you a bad recommendation for college, or withdraw a recommendation for college, which was what happened to one student up in Washington State, then we're not teaching our students to be good citizens and to be responsible about the use of their rights. So in summation, Mr. Chair, we would very much like to see the problem addressed. We're not sure that this specific bill is the best way to address the problem, but the problem is very real. Thank you.
Mr. Fedanke. Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much, Mr. Fedanke. And I just want to sort of maybe reaffirm some of the things that you said, make sure that I'm understanding them correctly. The Oregon appellate courts have, in general, been more protective of free speech rights than courts in other states. Is that correct?
That is correct. And, again, it's because our courts, I think, to their credit, have read the Oregon Constitution to mean what it says. and have assumed that when the framers of the Constitution wrote provisions in certain ways, that that language should have effect, should have a real meaning.
You may.
And the reason that the Oregon appellate courts, Supreme Court, hasn't expanded or confirmed the free speech rights of student journalists is because the journalists graduate before the courts get to their cases get to the higher courts.
Exactly, and the way the court reads its power in the Oregon Constitution is also directly related to the language in the Constitution that says there has to be, I mean, I don't have the exact language memorized, but essentially that there has to be a case, a real controversy between these parties that still exists at the time the court rules on the case.
One more follow-up.
Go ahead.
Thank you. And because Oregon, unlike all other states in any federal court, doesn't recognize that exception to the mootness doctrine for things that are capable of
repetition
yet evading review, we end up with no case law on student journalists' free speech rights.
That's correct.
And this bill doesn't do anything to address that in its current form?
Well, one of the provisions of the bill, while it creates a mechanism for student journalists to go into court, it does not provide for journalists to recover damages if, in fact, their rights were violated by school officials or university officials. And because the issue of damages would act to keep a case alive even after students graduated, it doesn't cure that problem in current practice.
Thank you very much.
Representative Krieger.
Maybe a comment. I'm reading a book on free speech at the time, and it starts out in about 1100. This is a comment, not a question for you, really, but at that time there was the Star Chamber courts in England, and I find it kind of, it was unlawful to publish, write, distribute, or even read certain papers that weren't approved by the government. There were only 20 licensed publishers in England at the time, and they made the determination of the appropriateness of what you could read. It was interesting, at the time it was the church that was doing the reviewing of the material before it could be published and you and I could have access to it. And then the Star Chamber Court would cut off the ears of those who were found to have published, read, in any way been involved in this type of literature. So we have made some progress.
We certainly have.
Senator Barker.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Kennedy. Thank you. I was on the journalism group at Portland State one time when they stopped a paper so we had to publish it elsewhere because they didn't like a picture that was in it. But I have another question just kind of on this same topic. I grew up, I'll be 64 on Sunday, so I grew up at a time when I learned Russia was really evil because they would block radio broadcasts. And I remember reading, and I was somewhat surprised in the 60s, that the little covey of people who escaped from China in 1949 and were heading under the skirts of 7th Fleet on Formosa wouldn't allow or would imprison anybody who listened to Radio Beijing. And I just learned the other night that English Al Jazeera is prohibited in America. They've stopped that, will not allow that to be broadcast because we can't, for some reason, I guess that would upset us. And I wonder, I mean, I'm just seeing this whole censorship thing. I was just amazed by that. I was floored by that. I just learned it two nights ago, but I just wondered if you had any comments on that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barker, I think your point is excellent because I'm too of a certain age, although not quite yours, but certainly close.
You are.
And I had the privilege of visiting the Soviet Union in 1969. It was a very turbulent time in our country, a lot of dissent going on. And when we met with the Russian students, And we said, you know, we know our government is capable of making mistakes. We think our government made a mistake in Vietnam. But we also think your government made a mistake by invading Czechoslovakia. Don't you think your government is capable of making mistakes? And they said, oh, no. No, we have the very best people in charge in our government. They would never do anything that wasn't in our best interest. It was an incredibly chilling moment for me because, of course, people in the Soviet Union didn't have access to any information that wasn't vetted by the highest levels of their government. And, of course, they also knew there were people everywhere who would report if they said something that was deemed dangerous or subversive to the revolution. And it certainly made me understand how precious our freedoms are in this country and the importance of defending our core freedoms. It's not always comfortable because sometimes people do say things that are deplorable or even dangerous. But again, I think the response that the rest of us need to have is to respond to that speech that we disagree with and educate our fellow citizens as to why a particular speech is dangerous and what's wrong with it, rather than and to have the restraint to not call on our government to censor that speech. In the long run, freedom will thrive when we all are able to speak, even when the things we say might be stupid.
Committee you. Members, I don't want to suppress expression, but we have a long agenda today, and so if there's something that really needs to be asked at this point, go ahead. But
Mr. Chair, thank you. Just a question is, and I'm just trying to get my hands around this, on a private newspaper such as the Oregonian or the Statesman Journal, aren't the final decisions of what would be printed or who could print that, aren't they in the hands of the management or the ownership? Could they tell the editor, no, you're not going to print that today?
Mr. Chair and Representative Cameron, absolutely.
Okay.
The publisher of a private newspaper has the First Amendment and Article 1, Section 8 on their side against the government. If the government were to try to prevent a private newspaper from publishing something or to force a private newspaper to publish something, the government would be violating the free press rights of that publication. The problem here is that it's the government who's the publisher. And we don't know, as a matter of Oregon law, whether the government has the same rights when it's the publisher as a private publication does. Speaking on behalf of the ACLU, we think that when the government is the publisher, it has a right to set basic ground rules. And in the case of a high school newspaper, a university newspaper, to say, to have an advisor, certainly at the high school level, who whose job is to teach those students the principles of journalism. I think that the difficult question is, how far can the government go when those student journalists are living up to the highest expectations of journalism, the highest standards of journalism, to be accurate, to write well, to make their points persuasively, and to be fair? Can the government, should the government, prevent the publication of a story merely because it might offend some taxpayers or members of the school board or others who will object to the content of that article? And that's the difficult question. Under the First Amendment, the U.S. Supreme Court has said has given fairly broad latitude, but not unlimited latitude, to school officials to control the content of student newspapers. Here in Oregon, we have no idea what the boundaries are under the Oregon Bill of Rights.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you all.
Thank you, Mr. Pedanke. I'm going to bring up a panel of two, I think, that are connected, J.D. McIntyre and Tiffany Fagel, is it? And I would urge, we do have several other bills on our agenda today, so I would make your points concisely, but we probably can't spend a long time further on this bill.
Chairman McPherson, members of the committee, my name is J.D. McIntyre, and I am a journalism educator at Sandy High School. I am the advisor of the school publications there. I am a certified journalism educator through the Journalism Education Association, and I have a bachelor's degree from the University of Oregon Journalism School. I'm also the current president of the Oregon Journalism Education Association. In a moment, I'll introduce Tiffany Fagel. She is my student editor at Sandy High School. In the vein of being brief here, I want to share a quick story from a student newspaper in Oregon that kind of illustrates the effects of the Hazelwood decision and how Bill 3279 would help right some of those effects. At Canby High School last year, a number of students on the staff of the newspaper there came across, as they often teenagers do when they're looking at MySpace.com, came across pages on MySpace.com that contained racist information or racist comments. These were made by students at Canby High School who were clearly identified. They brought this back to their advisor, proposed to write a story on racism at the school, both implied and overt. We're going to interview school officials, superintendent, principal, the voluntary host of this page on MySpace, who was more than happy to be interviewed, and develop this story. The advisor discussed it with the principal, as did the students involved, and they moved forward on it. As they did this, word got out to the local media, and before you knew it, there were a number of TV cameras and all sorts of people covering this in the professional media. As the students developed the story, and it got closer to publication time, the writer submitted the article to the principal in a draft form to kind of get a heads up on what was going on. The day the issue was to go to press, the principal got cold feet and pulled the article. Having no other article to put there, the paper published front page above the fold a big white space with the line "censored by administration." So as the students in the journalism room looked out their window and watched the professional media cover their story and talk about them and tell everybody what was going on in Canby High School, the students themselves had no ability to do the same. They were prevented by the Hazelwood decision, which allowed the principal to pull this article, citing pedagogical concerns. Reasonable educational justification is what the decision says. They were stuck. They had absolutely no recourse, and the paper went out with the hole in it. The advisor, who was an 8-year veteran of advising publications, was a candidate for the advisor of the year in this state in 2006, was reassigned. She is no longer allowed to be the advisor at Canby High School. This is the type of case that happens all the time. I think we can talk about things being able to be litigated or not litigated, or if there are any current cases, but this is what really happens in the classroom. Either individual articles pulled like this, or what I think at times is even worse, in that the students self-censor themselves. Oh, we can't talk about that. The administration won't let us talk about that. And they move on, and the stories are, you know, this year's prom theme. I really see this as an essential building block to education. 2 months ago, the Oregon Department of Education just submitted new standards for graduation for high school seniors. Among the standards was to give the students essential skills that include demonstrating civic responsibility and critical thinking, analytical thinking. And I cannot really come up with anything that is more essential than letting students explore and learn about a free press and their First Amendment rights. Thank you for your time. If you have any questions, I'd be willing to entertain them.
Thank you, Mr. McIntyre. Let's go to Ms. Fiegel, and then we can take questions for both of you.
Chairman McPherson and member of the committees, my name is Tiffany Fiegel. I am an 18-year-old student journalist at Sandy High School. I'm the editor-in-chief of the Mountain Echoes at Sandy, and this year I was awarded the title of the Oregon Journalist of the Year. Basically, as a student journalist, we are faced with the problem that with things like MySpace and the internet and the TV, many people believe that the newspaper is becoming obsolete, and that especially students, our readership is not the highest. We are encouraged to cover things that would interest our readers. That's what we do when we create story ideas, is come up with things that are interesting to our readers. However, it's hard to do this when we have to be careful of whose toes we are stepping on, and to make sure that when we cover something that could be considered controversial, that we do it in an appropriate manner, because if we don't, it could lead to the censorship of our entire publication. So we have to question ourselves if it's worth it or not. We, as Mr. McIntyre said, do question ourselves a lot. I know that I have, in topics that can be considered controversial, we just overlook them. We don't talk about them because we know that it could lead to the censorship of our paper. And I think that when we are told that high school is supposed to be preparing us for the real world, it's hard to understand how censoring us as students, how this can be a benefit to us. Thank you.
Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you so much, Mr. McIntyre, and your student for being here and bringing your student. I, too, have a journalism degree from the University of Oregon, and I think it's interesting how that in journalism school they always talked about free press, fair trial, but then when I got to law school, it all of a sudden became fair trial, free press, but that's a discussion for another day. The thing that concerns me, and I'm a parent of a son who is an editor of a high school newspaper, firm believer in free speech, what concerns me about this bill, and what I'd like to get your response as a journalism advisor, is that I'm concerned about the immunity, the way the immunity language is worded, because if this bill were passed, it grants immunity to the school district in certain circumstances. But I'm concerned that schools might, instead of this opening the opportunities for free press, I'm concerned that the schools might just say, this is too risky, we can't have a school newspaper. And what concerns me about it is that because in order to avoid lawsuits brought by censored students, if they try to censor the students, and here the language is altered the content of student expression. There's no definition of that. So if they try to supervise or alter the content of student expression, then they can be sued by the students. If they don't do that at all and just have unrestrained student speech, then they may have defamation or invasion of privacy written by students. And so they might say, this is just too risky of a situation. We're either going to get lawsuits from students, or we're going to have this issue over here with the unprotected speech completely. So I'm concerned that schools are going to say, we're not going to deal with that. We're just not going to have a newspaper. And that concerns me. And I'd like you to address that issue if you can.
Thank you, Representative Bonamici. That would concern me, too, if that was the effect. However, I would question that being the effect. I think the value of a free press and an active press. I know on a regular basis, I'm contacted by my school board, my superintendent, the principal, to cover worthwhile stories. And it is I'm lucky. I've never had my paper outright censored. And you know, as you know, I live in your district, just north of Beaverton, and I teach in Sandy, and that's 75 miles round trip every day for me. And I've had a number of people, including my wife, ask me why I don't get a job closer to home. And part of the reason is because I fear leaving the situation I have in Sandy. I've worked a long time to establish a good working relationship with those people. And my principal's attitude is you can cover anything you want as long as you cover it well. And so it would be up to those people, the advisor, the students, the superintendent, the principal, all these officials, to understand that fear is not a good motivator for determining curriculum. Fear of what might happen, I think, is a way to really suppress opportunities for teenagers. An effective, well-run publication department is invaluable in both situations, whether it's, you know, you're talking about problems from outside or problems with the students within. As long as it effectively ran, this is a issue of making the paper inside the school work.
Thank you.
Representative Krieger.
One question.
Very good.
I just wondered if you felt there was any responsibility regarding self-restraint or using judgment as to what you write and how it might affect school or the community or students.
I'm not sure I understand your question. The responsibility for...
Well, the content, in other words.
Mm-hmm.
Should they use some judgment and self-restraint about total expression or say it in the proper way? If you know it's a very controversial thing and there's a lot of division, would you think it should be moderated a little bit, how you say it, so that it's more acceptable?
Yes, I believe the students, my students, I can only really speak for my own students here, they are some of the most in-touch kids with the rest of the student body, and they understand the effects that their work has on other people. They still push their own opinions. They still develop their own stories and content, but generally, my students are the ones that are raising these questions. I don't have to. They are intelligent. They understand what journalism is, and they understand the role of the newspaper. And these kids, they know what's going on, and they know what could have possibly happened and what the ramifications are of their opinions and their coverage. And they take great pride in framing that coverage to be effective.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Cameron.
Thank you. Mr. McIntyre, thank you. On your last statement, how did they learn that?
Well,
how do they know?
I would hope that they learned some of it from me. Most of my students have gone through a journalism class. We do a, besides just teaching reading and writing and all those building blocks of journalism, we do a lengthy law and ethics session. Any new students who have not taken my journalism class get that with me one-on-one. Even the students who have taken the journalism class and are on the newspaper, we review that every year and go through what the law says they can and cannot do, what ethics, I think what's sometimes lost in all this is ethics. I believe that ethics really guide their decisions more so than the law very often.
Thank you.
No further questions. I'll excuse this panel. And in the interest of time, I'm going to be going to panels here for the remainder of this hearing. The next two will be Molly Bedford and Lauren Dillard.
Thank you.
Ms. Bedford, or whichever you prefer, actually could go first.
Good morning, Chair McPherson. My name is Molly Bedford. I'm the managing editor for the Oregon Daily Emerald, the independent student newspaper at the University of Oregon. You guys have my testimony in front of you. I'll just make it short and simple that student media fulfills a greater purpose than learning, the craft of journalism. It serves a purpose for us to be a watchdog to the student government and the university administration. Our learning experience at the University of Oregon needs to mirror our career. Government doesn't censor the professional world, and we should not be censored by the administration and student government. It should work in the same fashion as how they operate with the city, state, and federal governments. Censorship through prior restraint or after the fact via funding cuts hinders the ability to learn an environment that is indicative that we will operate in our careers.
All right. Chair McPherson, members of the committee, my name is Lauren Dillard. I am the editor-in-chief of the Oregon State University daily newspaper, The Daily Barometer. I'm testifying also on behalf of this bill. Also here for our spring break, I have my managing editor, Lindsay Schnell, who is a former Oregon High School Journalist of the Year. The Barometer currently operates under its own power, meaning that we are not funded at all by OSU. We sell advertising and keep costs very low to maintain our independence from the university. In the past year, I worked for the Barometer at about $2 an hour, but I do it because I love it, and I do it because I believe in the principles of journalism, and I know that my colleagues and my peers feel the same way. If we were to ask for funding from the university, we would risk losing that funding every time we print something that could be assumed to be against the university. OSU has faced students dying in dormitories, administrators receiving DUIs, and students receiving MIPs at university-sponsored events. We print all of it because we continue to have nothing to lose. In Corvallis, the Barometer is one of the best news sources for the community. It's the job of the news media to ask questions and challenge the behavior of those in powerful positions. Under the First Amendment, the freedom of the press is protected. I have been taught at OSU that the press is considered the fourth estate. We operate as a watchdog for our governing body. The scope of a university or high school paper is to cover the events of that particular campus, making the student government and school administration the most applicable governing body. It is an important principle of journalism that staff maintain an independence from the people and organizations that they cover. This legislation would protect student journalists, students who are learning to effectively serve the fourth estate in their efforts to expose the truth and provide information for the greater good. Journalists pride themselves on maintaining or on monitoring individuals in power. This is only possible if the publication itself does not face scrutiny prior to printing and threat to its financial stability. College and high school newspapers are training grounds, but they are also credible sources of news for their communities. This legislation will help accomplish all of these goals. You are presented with the unique opportunity to push legislation that has been passed in just six other states. In our day-to-day operation as a college newspaper, we are treated as a professional organization. It is a shame that our laws do not reflect that, and you now have the power to help change that. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Bedford. Ms. Dillard, any questions? And thank you for your work in journalism. I think while those of us in public life may chafe at times at the coverage we receive, we deeply appreciate what an important part of our democracy it is. Thank you very much. I'd like to invite a panel of three individuals forward now: Rob Melton, Brett Howlett, and Edward McGlure. And since you signed up in that order, I'll take you in that order and presentation.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, committee members. I have written testimony to save a little bit of time here to submit to you. I'm speaking to you, Rob Melton, for the record. Today I'm speaking to you as a father of a child who has been censored, as an Oregon journalism teacher for 27 years, a former board director of the National Journalism Education Association for 20 years, a former president of the State Journalism Teachers Association. I'm also a current member of the Oregon Education Association Board of Directors, University of Oregon School of Journalism graduate, and a former newspaper reporter and editor. And I wanted to begin just reminding us that this bill is not unprecedented. The The bill, in fact, has been in Iowa since 1989. Such a law has been there. Massachusetts since 1988, Kansas since 1992, and California since 1977. And in each of those states, no one has ever argued that the quality of education has diminished as a result of this type of law. And, in fact, some have argued that it, in fact, has strengthened the quality of education in those states. California. Now, regarding the concern for legal liability in Oregon, or for that matter, the rest of the United States, a school or district has never been held legally liable for something that was published in a student newspaper in a published legal opinion. And this is according to Mark Goodman, who's the director of the Student Press Law Center. And I believe this bill contains adequate protections to set those concerns to rest. Does this give law students more rights than others enjoy? No. Clearly, this law refers to the limitations upon mass media which exist in our legal system, libel, invasion of privacy, obscenity, clear and present danger, inciting unlawful acts. The very things which are taught to every high school and college journalist right after the lesson on what is news, who is your audience, and how do you write a news story. The lesson, just so you know, is always framed this way. You have rights, and within those rights come responsibilities. And thus begins in high school a year-long discussion about what the Fourth Estate can do, and then whether we should do it as we discuss the laws and ethics and the framework of informing the public about its democratic institutions. Student journalists must abide by the same laws as everyone else. Does this law assure that all voices will be heard, whether they're moderate, conservative, progressive, green, or other? Yes. Students must know that their voices are important, their opinions, when based on fact, are valued, and their news interests validated. And having worked with high school journalists both before and after the Hazelwood decision, I've seen students either reject ideas outright when they say the administration would never allow us to publish that, or worse, self-censorship when they just won't even mention it because they knew it would never get published. Now, I believe that if a story is going to get killed, it should be by student journalists who kill it because they have thoroughly examined the subject, debated their concerns, and made that decision themselves, frequently with the guidance of their student media advisor. I believe this bill will help restore the balance and vibrancy of a healthy, spirited student press and the intellectual freedom to power. Do we need such a law? Absolutely. The effect of the Hazelwood decision has had a chilling effect on the high school media and now potentially on the college media. Although I have a degree in journalism from the University of Oregon, experience as a reporter and editor, and a license to teach with a journalism endorsement, one of my principals recently opened her administrator textbook and showed me the one-paragraph summary of Hazelwood for administrators. Do you know what it said? It said the principal controls the content of school publications. For any of you who have studied the Hazelwood decision, this is a shocking simplification of the ruling. The textbook said nothing else about the role students should play in a class which is studying journalism, producing the high school newspaper, and led by a highly qualified teacher. In fact, let me tell you a story about my own son, who as a freshman at Benson Polytechnic High School, where I teach, wrote a story about a senior who had graduated the previous year. This senior had committed a grisly murder. The newspaper staff learned of it from students who knew him from when he was at school. It was later, as you may remember, featured prominently in the local newspaper and on TV. My son was assigned to write the story, which included reaction from students who knew this former student. I worked closely with the writer, yes, my son, in the development of the story. We discussed many of the issues and ethical problems it presented. It was an opportunity for real learning to take place. The editor read it and decided it would go on page one. Now, when the paper arrived, the vice principal locked the papers up and refused to allow the staff to distribute them because of that story. We pleaded with him to allow us to distribute the paper, which had timely information for that particular day. In the meantime, the student editor called Mark Goodman, director of the Student Press Law Center, for advice. And as a result of that conversation, the staff started a whisper campaign. They asked all of their friends to start asking any school official they saw, "Where's my newspaper?" Word spread like wildfire. Soon, even staff members were asking where the newspapers were. We had to wait until the principal returned on Monday afternoon, and she and I had a heated discussion over the issue. She mentioned all the people who were asking, "Where is the newspaper?" She agreed to distribution the next day, but insisted on having grief counselors present for students who might be disturbed with the news. Mark Goodman helped us stay focused on the goal, getting the newspaper in the hands of our readers. Mission accomplished, civics lesson learned, no student showed up for grief counseling. My point here is this was a solid piece of journalism, a reaction story to something that was of concern to our audience, which in fact we had found out about from our readers who told us about it before it was public knowledge. Sometimes these days we find ourselves just fighting to be heard rather than studying, questioning, discussing, and debating important issues of the day. This is a good bill. It's long overdue. I urge you to support this legislation. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Melton. Let's hear from Mr. Howlett.
Good morning, Chair McPherson, members of the committee. My name is Brett Rollett. I'm legislative director for the Oregon Student Association. We represent over 100,000 college students at Oregon's universities, community colleges, and OHSU, and I'm here today on behalf of OSA to ask for your support on House Bill 3279. And I'll keep it short. I think it's more important that we hear from students today. But there's two aspects of the bill. There's the part that protects journalists, student journalists in our high schools, but also addressing the issue of colleges and universities now. Up until recently, we felt that student journalists in university systems were protected because the Hazelwood decision specifically mentioned high school journalists. But because of the Hosley decision and the Supreme Court's refusal to take up an appeal on that decision, universities now have the right to censor student publications. Now, one can argue that Oregon law may prohibit that from happening, and you can take it to court and possibly win. But we're here today to ask you to pass this bill so it will specify that Oregon's universities and community colleges do not have the right to censor student journalists in their publications. We've heard from a couple editors of student papers at our universities, and fortunately for them, they're independent. Some of our larger universities with the student newspapers that are funded through the student incidental fee, they've been able to become independent and separate themselves from the university. And they write stories that are important for students to hear on a regular basis, whether it's at the U of O where students have learned that their potatoes in the food services were being washed in a dishwasher with chemicals, bleach, and so forth, or at OSU where there were student deaths in the dorms, or administrators with DUIs, or even up at Portland State where they just learned that their president is, there's a college out east trying to lure their president away from their school. These are all stories that are important for students to hear about, and oftentimes it results in change for the betterment of students on campuses. Unfortunately, student publications that are not fully supported by the student incidental fee and are independent of the college. There are numerous publications on university campuses and community college newspapers that are not independent, that have not become independent corporations. They're sponsored organizations by the school. It could be the Multicultural Center's newsletter that has student journalists from the journalism school writing articles on the importance of a diversity plan for the campus and maybe the administration's reluctance to pass a diversity plan. Those types of stories have the potential to be censored under the Hosley decision. And so we ask for your support on this legislation. We feel it's in the betterment of the students on our campuses. It's also in the betterment of the journalism students. They'll be able to practice their field in the same system that they're going to do once they're outside of college. And that's in the best interest of all Oregonians, too, because we don't want student journalists to learn their skills in the system that censors them and then graduate, and we have to rely upon students that weren't able to learn in a system with completely free speech to give us our news then. So please, on behalf of OSA, ask that you support House Bill 3279. Thank you for the opportunity to speak this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Roulette. Mr. McGlure.
Thank you. Chairman McPherson, members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity to come testify before you. For the record, my name is Edward McGlone. I'm a senior at Beaverton High School, which is actually built in Representative Barker's district and draws students from Representative Bonamici as well as Representative Reed's district. I am a former news and sports editor for The Hummer. I also think it's important to point out I do work for Representative Reed, yet speak only on my own behalf. I come before you in strong support of House Bill 3279. In my experience as an editor for The Hummer, I have learned the firsthand value and necessity of having First Amendment protections. To condense those experiences, I provide you two crucial reasons that these protections are valuable and necessary. First, the educational process, and second, journalistic integrity. Because you have my written testimony, I'm going to abridge that even further. I hope we can all agree that schools serve a dual purpose for students to learn about the core subjects as well as to learn, practice, and appreciate their rights. Reasonably so, then, classes serve for students to learn about a specific subject. When students take a journalism class, they do so expecting what it may be like to be an actual journalist. However, without First Amendment protection rights, that simply is impossible. Under current standards, students are not allowed to practice freedom of press in journalism classes. Censorship by the administration is not always obvious, but subtle and increasingly present. One specific example of this not-so-subtle administrative censorship occurred recently at Tigard High School in Representative Galizio's district. A reporter was writing an article about a certain new school rule. After meeting with a school board member, an administrator of Tigard High School called the student in to, quote, get the facts straight about the specific article. This perfectly exemplifies the subtle censorship and control that administrations attempt to act over school newspapers. Interestingly, our high school's principal, Ms. Janice Adams, said in an interview with the Hummer that students do not leave their First Amendment rights at the schoolhouse door. If such is the case, then why does the school maintain editorial control over a newspaper which has provided nothing but fair and honest coverage of the news? Increased administration censorship causes students to devalue and misunderstand their rights. In a recent study conducted by the Knight Foundation, it was found that 49% of high school students thought it was acceptable for a government to censor the press. This is concerning to me and shows a clear loss of value for one's rights, which also negates a major tenet of our educational system, the ability to practice, learn, and appreciate one's rights. If an administrative body is given blanket approval to censor the press, the integrity of journalists and their publications is immediately violated. Writers are no longer able to report the facts because they are either afraid of retribution or because their work is changed and altered by administrators. I think Thomas Jefferson put it better, saying, "Our liberty depends on the freedom of the press, and that cannot be limited without being lost." I don't contend that school censorship is threatening our collective liberties. However, I am of a complete agreement that we cannot censor the press or limit it without it being lost altogether. When school administrations limit or alter what is being reported, any validity of that information is lost. People cannot trust a press that is neither fair nor independent. I compare a censored press to another piece of literature I'm sure we're all familiar with, and that's campaign literature. It serves a distinct purpose and contains factual information. However, that information is also not completely independent. It's pointed to look make a candidate or certain issue look more favorable. As well, a school administration, when censoring material published in a newspaper, is trying to avoid bad publicity, making a policy look bad, or possibly insulting parents. Members of the committee, I greatly appreciate your time and attention. I strongly urge you to support House Bill 3279. The censorship of student newspapers is contrary to the educational process and violates journalistic integrity. If we want our students to learn, we should allow them to learn what it's actually like to participate in activity. Protecting censorship of the press does not achieve this. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McLoughlin. If there are no questions, then I'll excuse this panel. We have one final panel on House Bill 3279, Chuck Bennett and David Williams.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Chuck Bennett. I represent the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. Mr. Chairman, my background has included lobbying as well as serving in the legislature, but prior to that, I actually had a professional life as a newspaper reporter and editor on a daily newspaper here in Salem, as well as a couple of weeklies. I also, in the mid-70s, was an adjunct instructor of journalism at Willamette University, and that was sort of where I thought my life was going to head until I got so interested in politics. But during that period, Mr. Chairman, I had the opportunity to actually work in the profession I'm listening to being described today, and I found it to be valuable, interesting, and always an opportunity to exercise my First Amendment rights until I ran into the reality of making a living. I worked for former Congressman Denny Smith, who was the owner of the newspaper I worked for in Woodburn. I worked for the Gannett Corporation, which owned the newspaper here in Salem after purchasing it from the Mainwaring family. And I worked for Frank Crow at the State and Mail. In each case, they own the newspaper, and I think it runs to a couple of points that I want to underline in today's discussion. They determined what it went into that newspaper. Whether I was editor or reporter, they own the newspaper. The dilemma, the problem, I think, with this discussion today, really came from Representative Cameron's question to Mr. Fedanke. And that's the dilemma of a government-owned newspaper and how that works and how the policies are developed around it. And that really runs to the locally elected school board and school administrators and how that's developed. We would be fascinated to work with Representative Galizio and Representative this committee in developing how that relationship operates because, and I think this runs to questions from Representative Bonamici, we don't want to end up with lawsuits on both ends of this question resulting in a limitation on student journalist opportunities, school newspapers. What we are not talking about here at any point is off-campus papers, the new internet opportunities, that whole variety of privately owned opportunities, nor are we talking about campus newspapers. Very different issue. Although in listening to the description of all of the experiences today, I realize this is a great story told by anecdote, not a lot of direct experience or evidence, I think, was presented today. I was pleased to hear about the real school administrators who support their student newspapers, support the education opportunity that exists here, and then I was also as interested, and I'll make a couple calls, in the anecdotal school administrators that are censoring newspapers. I would really like to know the whole story, and I don't think we got it this morning in those cases. But the bottom line, Mr. Chairman, is we stand ready at any time to sit down with advocates who are concerned about this to figure out how we take an educational opportunity in our public schools and improve on it. We're always ready to do that, and I think that probably comes under school policy.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Bennett. Mr. Williams.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. David Williams with the Oregon School Boards Association. Not much to add, just to second the comments made by Mr. Bennett, and to highlight again the concerns for us raised by the bill, especially pointed out by Representative Bonamici regarding liability of the district and some of the language around whether or not a district is interfering or even consulting with the student newspaper and the liability that raises for a district. Also substantial concern about the fact that it appears that this piece of legislation might open a district up to any number of lawsuits from not just legitimate student journalists working for the student newspaper, but students who just may be disgruntled at the district, opening districts up to a flood of lawsuits, First Amendment challenges, which, of course, take a substantial amount of time. And to, again, say we'd be happy to, if there is a substantial concern here, we would be happy to sit down with all parties to see if we can't craft an amenable compromise.
Very good. If there are no questions, then I'll excuse this panel. Thank you, gentlemen, very much for waiting through that long hearing to present. Representative Kopp.
Just a comment, and as a school administrator, I do believe that it is important to have some clear guidance on this for particularly high school students. It's been my experience there's absolutely censorship happening on a regular basis in schools, not only about school newspapers, but what is said at public assemblies, what is said at graduation. There are school administrators that won't allow certain students to have the free right of speech. And so I don't believe this is a minor issue in that we ought to take it seriously and see what we need to do to make sure free rights of speech are acknowledged in school policy in particular and followed in our public schools.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know this isn't a work session, but I want to reiterate the importance of the issue.
Right.
And I think one of the big issues for me is that I think we need to do what we can to make sure that our Supreme Court and our courts can give that guidance. And they're hindered from doing that now because they don't have that exception to the mootness, so that we can't get a ruling on this issue because the students graduate. And if we can resolve that that problem, I think we'll get more guidance for schools from our courts, which, as we all know, broadly interpret our interpret our free speech clause in our Oregon Constitution. So I think we should talk about how we can get that guidance from our courts.
Right.
Very good. Appreciate those comments. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3279. We have three bills that were set for hearing today. Two of them are a carryover from prior hearings where we were not able to hear those witnesses, and so we will be taking those first in order, House Bill 2448 and 2909. I hope to hear from at least some of the witnesses on the final bill on the agenda, House Bill 3313, yet. But I do want it, because we were not able to hear the witnesses on those first two bills, to get to those today. So open a public hearing on House Bill 2448. And I think we'll go first to Jim Gardner, because he was the next one signed up when we had the last were hearing on this bill.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jim Gardner, and I'm appearing today for the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America in opposition to both House Bill 2909 and House Bill 2448. I'm going to focus my discussion on the broader bill, House Bill 2909, and simply note with regard to the other bill, which is a carve-out from the statute of repose for COX-2 medications, that we think it's inappropriate to essentially cherry-pick particular products and create a special statute of limitations or statute of repose for individual products. I recognize that there may be that the legislature has done that in the past, and there may be some exceptions that are appropriate, but do not feel that this particular this falls into that category.
Mr. Gardner, I'd opened 2448. Why don't I open the public hearing on 2909 as well, then, so that your remarks are germane to both bills?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Let me begin with a brief trip down memory lane. And the veterans of this committee may have a recollection of this. It was the 2003 session, and the Oregon Supreme Court, in a somewhat, I wouldn't say ill-considered, but a decision that did not resonate well with certain members of the bar, the Gladhart case. The Oregon Supreme Court had interpreted Oregon's statute of repose, statute of limitations law in a really quite a harsh way, and had read it to essentially create a two-year statute of ultimate repose. The trial bar, their OTLA, the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association, was understandably concerned about this development, and arranged to have introduced House Bill 2080, which is part of the documents that I've given to you. House Bill 2080 from the 2003 session. I and other members of the business community were faced with a choice at that point. And the choice was whether or not to essentially attempt to block a piece of legislation that would have the effect of restoring the status quo ante, the law as it was generally understood before the Gladhart decision, or whether to work with the Trial Lawyers Association to craft essentially a bill that would replicate what most practitioners understood to have been the law before the Gladhart decision. And I would say, largely on my advice, whether it was right or wrong, we decided to take the latter course and to work with the Trial Lawyers Association to essentially restore to the law to what most people had understood to have been prior to the Gladhart decision. That was House Bill 2080. And that bill, as enacted, is the law that currently exists today. In other words, what has been characterized as the Sauer Law was the result of a careful negotiation and compromise between the business community and the Trial Lawyers Association in the 2003 session. And I just want to highlight a couple of things that are in the packet that begins with House Bill 2080. The first is on page 2 of the minutes of this before this committee, and on at 0.460, Richard Lane, Oregon Trial Lawyers Association, states this is almost a consensus bill as far as correcting two mistakes caused by the Gladhart and the Canberry cases. And then when we get over to the Senate side, you see there the Senate Committee on Judiciary minutes, page 2, down on tape B, 0.027, about almost to the end of the page. Richard Lane, Oregon Trial Lawyers Association, testifies in support of House Bill 2080A, explains the purpose of this legislation, and gives examples of when it would be needed. It was a consensus bill, the law that you see before you. Now, I continue to recognize the need for compromise, for accommodation, and for accommodation. I have a chart for your consideration that was prepared by the American Tort Reform Association that compares the statutes of repose in all 50 states. There are some minor differences from the OTLA chart. It is in more detail, but it gives you a kind of a sense of what other states have done. I also include in your packet a document that was prepared by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce called 2006 State Liability Systems Ranking Study. And the reason I have included this is because in evaluating the tort climate, the tort reform climate in a particular state, and the wisdom or lack of wisdom of making a change to a particular element of the tort system, it is vitally important that you place that proposed change in the context of the overall tort climate. For instance, when you look at Washington's tort climate, you need to look at the fact that there are no punitive damages in Washington state. When you look at Oregon's tort climate, you need to acknowledge that the 1987 legislation that was adopted as a part of a tort reform package that capped non-economic damages at $500,000 was thrown out by the Oregon Supreme Court in the Lakin decision because it was held that violated the Oregon Supreme Court. That kind of a reform is present in other states. So you have to look at the entire picture. And that's what the U.S. Chamber of Commerce study did. And you'll see that on the second page of that document looks like this. In the second page of that, according to their evaluation, and this is done by general counsel, senior attorneys for Fortune 500 companies, and the people that help make decisions about where to locate a plant or a new business investment, Oregon ranks 30. Not the worst, but definitely in the lower half of the class. Recognizing that some mitigation of this law might be appropriate in order to bring it more into line with those states which do have statutes of repose for product liability action, we have prepared the Dash 2 amendments, and what they basically do is add 4 years to all the numbers that are in the current law. In other words, the base period goes from 8 to 12 years, and the outer limit period goes from 10 to 14 years. We think that is a major concession on the part of the business community. We'd commend them to your attention, and I think I'll leave it at that and stand ready to answer questions.
Okay. Those are Amendment to 2909. Got it.
To 2909, yes. Are there any questions of Mr. Gardner?
I have a
question. Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Gardner. We heard in the last hearing on this bill that Washington State has a useful life test, and I find that a bit intriguing because, well, for many reasons, but what's your thought on the useful life and how is that working? And I especially am interested because I think it will lower the statute of repose in some cases and increase it in some cases, depending on the product.
Chair, Representative Bonamici, you know, I had that same thought, and it's just been brought to my attention that was of interest to the proponents to look at that. I have a couple of comments about the Washington law, and I'm looking at it right now. It is a more porous law in the sense of it's not as tight as whatever the period might be that would be appropriate as the Oregon law, because there are, for the reason that you mentioned, the useful life period could be shorter or longer. There's a rebuttable presumption that it's 12 years. And I was asking some of my colleagues, what's the useful life of a medication? Is it 4 hours, the half-life of after you ingest it? Is it 1 year, which is the shelf life typically that you'll see at a pharmacy? And that didn't seem an appropriate period of time for a statute of repose. That was shorter than the Glidehart decision. And then I sort of asked myself, what would a court be likely to do when faced with a contention that the useful life is a year, let's say? And I think what they would be likely to do is to be propelled down to one of the exceptions in the Washington law, which is the latency exception. I don't think a judge would, in good conscience, allow a defendant with a straight face to make an argument that period of time is that's what the useful life, even though it may be the useful life. And so I think that from both the plaintiff's perspective and the defense perspective, it doesn't yield the kind of element of certainty that is desirable. I certainly can understand that the argument in favor of it, but I just, when you actually apply it, thinking about applying it to a medication, it doesn't seem to fit.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Representative Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Gardner, for testifying and for bringing both of these interesting documents. I was curious. I wouldn't want to ask you to speak for the U.S. Chamber Institute, but I was looking at the rankings and then sort of comparing that to the tort reform chart and wondering how you view those two, the connections that might or might not exist between those two. Would seem like maybe the attitudes would follow where the laws of various states are, but also in looking at them seems like maybe they're not as connected. Could you comment on that, please?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Breed, thank you. I think that obviously the Chamber's document reflects a business community point of view, but in terms of your specific question, structurally, the ATRA chart isolates and focuses on one particular element of the tort reform, of the tort climate, which is the statute of repose element, whereas the Chamber's document attempts to take a global look at the entire tort climate in particular states. So it's I think that kind of hopefully illustrates my point that Oregon may look, let's say, business-friendly in terms of the statute of repose element, but other elements of the Oregon tort system, for instance, the fact that we can't impose limits on non-economic damages under the rule of the Oregon Supreme Court, the fact that we have a highly robust system of punitive damages, probably perhaps one of the most robust in the country, would go into a broader assessment of the tort climate.
Thank you.
Okay. If there are no further questions, we'll excuse Mr. Gardner. We are, just to remind you, in a public hearing on both House Bill 2448 and 2909. Let's hear from Dave Barrows. Okay, very good. Thank you, Mr. Barrows. Larry Barron signed up on House Bill 2448.
Good morning, Representative McPherson and members of the committee. I am a lawyer, and my practice is centered on medical malpractice and products liability cases. I was the lawyer for Ann Kirkwood. Mrs. Kirkwood was the lady who was here a couple weeks ago, and she was the victim of the General Motors side saddle tank pickup truck and had lost a good portion of her body to the flames and had lost her granddaughter to the flames in that particular crash. I also represent five victims of Vioxx, and I thought it might be helpful to address this committee to clear up questions and distinctions between the law here in 2448 and the issues dealing with Sauer. I think it's important to understand what this bill is and why there's a need for it, speaking of the Cox 2 legislation bill here, 2448. Vioxx came on the market in 1999, and it was withdrawn from the market in September of 2004. So it had a five-year run. The drug itself was pulled from the market by its manufacturer, Merck, who acknowledged that it was causing strokes and heart attacks. The problem that occurred for many Oregonians was that they had been taking Vioxx as long ago as 1999 and 2000 and 2001 when the drug was being strongly promoted over television and by doctors. And they had suffered their strokes or their heart attacks. And 2 years had come and gone by the time they ever heard about the connection between Vioxx and heart attacks and strokes. They had no remedy. They could not go to court because the statute of limitations had already expired even before they knew they had a cause of action. And so this legislation attempts to address that. It attempts to give these particular Oregonians the opportunity to go to court now that they have learned of the connection between Vioxx and their strokes or their heart attacks. So that's why we need this particular bill. This bill differs from Sauer. This particular bill is not a law that addresses the statute of ultimate repose. The drugs in this case that were taken by my clients and by other Oregonians, the drugs were right off the store shelf. They were certainly less than 8 years old. So the statute of ultimate repose does not bar a lawsuit for Vioxx victims. What bars a lawsuit for Vioxx victims is the statute of limitations. Statute of limitations begins to run from the date of the injury, not from the date that the product is made. Statute of limitations here ran for these Vioxx victims from 2 years from the date of their stroke, even though they did not know of the connection between the stroke and Vioxx. If we adopt the changes to the Sauer law as proposed by HB 2909, that will not be a remedy for the Vioxx victims that are here in Oregon. These Vioxx victims need a change to the statute of limitations. This particular bill addresses a glitch that is present in the Oregon law. If these Vioxx victims had taken their Vioxx in the 1990s, or even if they took it today, and if this situation came up today or in the 1990s, they would be able to go to court. Because in the 1990s, and even today, it's recognized that you have 2 years from the date that you learn the cause of your stroke or your injury. This goes back to the Gladhart case, which is what Mr. Gardner was speaking of. Everybody, it had always been the law in Oregon, as a matter of fundamental fairness, that you would have 2 years to go to court from the date that you learned the cause of your injury. But that right was taken away by the Gladhart decision in the year 2001. The legislature recognized that that was an unfair interpretation of the statute, and they restored to Oregon and to Oregonians the opportunity to go to court 2 years from the date of that they learned the cause of their injury, not 2 years from the date of their injury, because they may not know the cause of their injury. That right was restored in 2004. So today, all Oregonians have the right that these VIACS victims are seeking. And in the 1990s, all Oregonians had the right that these particular limited number of Oregonians are seeking. There was a brief period in time when Glatthart took away the right to go to court and made a very strict interpretation of our statute of limitations. As it turned out, that strict interpretation has now captured a class of Oregonians, and those are the VIACS victims. So it's a glitch in our law that these particular victims do not have the same rights that Oregonians used to have and that Oregonians have today. So it's a matter of fundamental fairness that these particular Oregonians should have the same rights as all other Oregonians have enjoyed in the past and enjoy today. A representative of Flores last weekend addressing the Sauer Law, I think, asked the question, can the Oregonians go to a different state if they're injured by a product? And can they go somewhere else even if Oregon will not let them go to court? And that was a very good question. Some of these VIACS victims have gone to other states in the hope that some other state will allow them to present their case. However, the traditional view of another state is that when someone like an Oregonian comes into their state, they will typically apply the statute of limitations from the state that the party is coming from. That's usually what happens. There has been no decision that I'm aware of with respect to the limited number of VIACS victims that have gone to either the federal system or the courts or cases are being handled in New Orleans or New Jersey, where the other cases are centered. There's no decision yet by the federal judge on this question of which statute of limitations will apply. Will it be the federal system in Louisiana, or will it be New Jersey's statute of limitations? But if the traditional view is taken, the Oregon statute of limitations will be applied, and these Oregonians who have been forced to go to other states or other jurisdictions will still be out of luck. So the mere fact that some victims of products have chosen to go to other states, that is not necessarily a remedy for them. The last time this bill, I'm sorry.
Baird, we are due on the floor at 10:30. We actually have another bill I was hoping to get at least introduced to the committee today. So if we could.
I would just say this in response to Mr. Gardner's comments. He made the same comments the last time this bill was up. It was Senate Bill 1011. And that he made the comment that we made a compromise in the 2003 legislature, but Senator Burdick responded to Mr. Gardner's comments last time that we were here. She said, did we know about the VIACS victims in 2003? And he conceded that we didn't, and she asked him, would it have made a difference? Would we have left this door closed on Oregonians if we knew that they had their rights being abridged? And Mr. Gardner quite fairly conceded that probably we would not have adopted that bright line and kept the door closed on these Oregonians. The last time this bill was here was Senate Bill 1011. It did pass the Senate. It had the votes to pass in the House, but it was not given a hearing on the floor. I'm hoping that that mistake, and I think that tragedy, will not happen again, and we'll ask you to vote in favor of this bill. Thank you for your comment, for your time.
I have a very quick question.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Barron. Do you have any estimate of, I know you said you had five clients, any estimate of how many people we're talking about?
You know, I don't. I could only give an educated guess, but I would say less than 50.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Barron. We have one more witness who signed up on one of these bills that are open for the public hearing, House Bill 2909, is Don Miner. Don, Mr. Miner, can you? That would be much appreciated.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Don Miner here on behalf of Oregon Manufactured Housing Association. Our association represents manufacturers and distributors of manufactured homes, as well as manufacturers of prefabricated structures. And we're here in support of the Dash 3 Amendment to House Bill 2909. The effect of that amendment would be to make clear that factory-built or factory-constructed buildings are subject to the same time limits as apply to other types of buildings.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Miner. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2909 and House Bill 2448.
We have another bill that we really have no time to hear, and so I want to, with apologies to the people who come to testify, let's talk about the distance from which people have come. I know Jim Austin and Andrea Hall are signed up in favor of the bill, and is it a difficulty for you to come back and... Okay, very good. And then we have Ken Sherman, Jr., who has signed up. Mr. Sherman, is it a difficulty for you to return to another day?
No.
Very good. Well, then we will roll that hearing over. We're not in the building tomorrow, so that will be rolled over for our next calendar daily, the first order of business on Monday, April the 2nd. That concludes our agenda for today. We're adjourned.